The following is an at-will presentation.
Welcome to The Marrow, conversations with creatives about who they are and why they make what they make. I'm your host, Josh Reebok.
Today, I'm talking with Missy Modell, a songwriter, an extraordinarily introspective woman whose openness and vulnerability I was immediately drawn to.
Are you a nervous person?
It's an interesting question because I don't know if I appear nervous, but I definitely battle a bit of anxiety.
A bit. So if you say a bit of
and
anxiety,
and by bit, I mean
now
I'm on Lexapro.
Yeah. I was like, anytime someone says they start with a bit of anxiety, that means there's a whole fat
I've been in therapy since I'm 7 years old.
Yeah. They're number one on my speed dial.
Yeah.
I'm such an anxious person.
Are
That's
you?
Why I asked. Yeah. I don't know how to hang out with people. I read the whole Prince quote. He said, cool is being able to walk into a room and not be scared of anyone. And I go, then I'm so uncool. I've never been the cool person in a room for my entire life.
Yeah. I don't know what even cool means. What does cool mean?
What does it mean to you, Missy?
I think, Josh, cool. I think cool is being comfortable with who you are. I think it has to be an internal thing.
Yeah.
Because for me, I think whenever I think of me feeling cool, it's always me feeling myself, honestly.
Yeah.
It is. I think that's like my version of enlightenment. I don't know.
That sounds good.
And it's a very, they come in very finite bits in my life.
Right.
It comes, but I don't know.
So why would someone in your position and who's accomplished the things that you have, what reason would you possibly have to not be cool with you?
I think it's like a nature versus nurture situation. I think your past sometimes, despite what you've done and what you're doing presently and what you look forward to doing in the future, you have a bit of past that kind of haunts you. Hmm. If that makes sense. Like, I still have we all have our demons and we all have our experiences that have shaped us.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And I think it's hard. I can't imagine. I don't know if you feel the same way, but social media now has definitely attributed to a lot of anxiety, as we kind of discussed before, the anxiety part.
Yeah.
You're in a constant comparison.
Yeah.
To people's external things of themselves. Do you know what I mean? It's very interesting.
For me, comparison is, I mean, psychological cancer for me, you know, and I'm good enough. Sadly, I have the gift of self-cruelty, you know, and so regardless of what other people may be proud of me for, I have this terrible skill of being able to deconstruct their argument of why I should be proud of those things. And my 12-step sponsor told me years ago, he said that I have the devastating ability to find shameful even the things that I should find most pride in.
Yeah.
And so and there's a lot of truth to that. And so for me, when it comes to social media, I'm not really engaged in that world. And part of it is it doesn't foster creativity in me. I find it to be the equivalent of just consuming sugar. Like, it feels good, but it doesn't really provide any nutritional benefit to my heart and mind. But the other thing with it just being, I don't know, feeling a little bit toxic to me is I just don't find it very interesting. You know, like, to me, it's rare when I find something on there that I find nearly as engaging as a book or film or a conversation like this or walking outside. And so I don't know, I guess I feel like it ends up being a waste of time, or at least it's not the way I want to spend my time. And typically when I spend, the more time I spend in that world, the less the man that I want to become actually unfolds. And I think that's probably the root of my anxiety and kind of self-loathing. It's the gap between the man I am and the man I think the world wants me to be. It's that gap where I can kind of fill it with anxiety and fear. And so when I sit across from you and I sit down and I go, she thinks I should be this, she wants me to be this, and I see the gap between those things and what I am, and then I just kind of, you know, spiral down that, you know, corrosive carousel that never seems to stop spinning.
So where do you think that stems from?
Well, you know, I'm sure Sigmund Freud would tell me that there's some horrible father wound, and though that would be a little bit reductive in its analysis, there's certainly some truth to that. But at some point, you know, I learned to do things that satisfied me in the short term, but in the long term have been really destructive. And so I think in the short term, as I saw my parents' marriage falling apart and I felt rejected by my dad and he wasn't around, I think in the short term, I found a solution in going, it's because I'm this, whatever that was, whatever the flaws, whatever the ugliness, I said, that's why. And it helped me make sense. I mean, I feel like as humans, we have this addiction to making sense of our lives, right? Mm-hmm. And that's how I made sense of it. And so while it aided me in the moment and in the short term, that belief never went away. And so it's become really, really destructive into my adult years. I used to teach sex ed. Mm. I don't know how effective I was at it. But when I was trying to get my writing career off the ground, I needed a second job. And so I taught sex ed in Austin, Texas, public high schools.
I had a focus in sexuality. I was a psychology
major. We're
going
to high five across the table.
Woo!
You know what?
Muffled voices began. That was my thesis.
At Skidmore.
It's good memory.
Yeah.
And good research.
There you go. Did you like it?
I loved it. Skidmore for me, I think for me, college was one of the most shaping experiences of my entire life. And I don't know if that's a cliche or if it's just my truth, but I had a really hard prior schooling experience. Like my middle school years and my high school years were pretty traumatic.
How so?
Oh my God. I mean,
other than just the Saved by the Bell fashion being replicated in all
and
our lives.
And like the hormonal shifts. No, I think I was unfortunately a product of some severe bullying, but to the point where I had to switch schools and we moved from Long Island, which I don't really like to promote. Okay. and I've since lost my accent. Hopefully.
I don't notice it.
No? Oh, good.
No,
okay. I've become a little more neutral, I think. My mom still has her, and my dad, very strong pride for the island. No, but I think for me, college was just extremely important because it's funny, when I think of me and who I am and who I want to be, I think of my summers in middle school and in high school because that was kind of where I escaped from this nonsense and I actually was in a place where I felt accepted for who I was. Because it's really hard to be different, and I don't like to say that I'm different, but I always felt that I was not somebody to just follow the crowd and want to be like everybody else. I didn't look like everybody else. I was very gangly and had very curly, Jewy hair, and I had different interests. Like I had big dreams, and I kind of put them on hold for fear of not being accepted. So I didn't want to like showcase this weirdness about myself.
What did you feel like that? I don't know, that culture that you were growing up in those years, what do you feel like they wanted you to be?
They wanted me to be ambivalent. It was cool to be angsty. It was cool to do drugs and it was cool to drink. And I was brought up in an environment where my parents didn't really drink. They didn't really they weren't partiers. They were pretty chill. And they were never telling me not to drink. It wasn't this kind of very strict household. It was very chill. But I never felt the urge, and I think maybe my anxiety, too, it didn't really do well with me to drink and do drugs at that age. And as I've gotten older, I've obviously experimented and, you know, done my thing.
Sure, you found out what that water,
exactly,
the temperature of that
what
water.
That tasted.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. I don't even know where this is coming from. It's like we're like on the couch right now.
I love it.
Yeah, but I don't know what the question was to begin with. But
the question is however you respond to me, like
answer
anything however you want. But that all led obviously into some really formidable years. So when in this whole thing, because you are a, I don't know, I don't even want to say singer and songwriter because I feel like that's like a stagnant term that doesn't really say, I think, what you do. But you certainly have a bond with music.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you first become aware that there was a certain kind of matrimony between you and music?
I just remember ever since, it was so generic to say because I feel like a lot of singers are like, ever since I was born, I'm a singer. I came out singing.
Yeah, right.
But no, my mom was a singer and she sang jingles on the radio and she was in off-Broadway shows. Hmm. And my great-grandmother, so it's kind of in my blood. She was like this big, big band backup singer.
Oh yeah.
So it's funny. It's just very much like a part of who I was. And I have pictures of me when I was like 3 years old, like banging on a little drum set and playing the piano. So I've always been kind of musical. And then I started singing the national anthem at all these events. And I then was doing recitals and I was in NISMA. I don't even know if it's like a national singing competition. And so I've always been very ambitious. And then I guess it's funny. If I really think about a point, it's like I just stopped. I lost the drive because my parents got divorced, and then I was kind of like mulling through that and trying to figure out my life.
Yeah.
And I got scared. I'm like, well, who am I? I had this like weird identity crisis, and that kind of carried over until college.
Yeah, so this was in that kind of middle school, high school
time of life. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, who am I? I cut my hair really short, trying to look like Cameron Diaz and my best friend's wedding. It didn't work. And I was like growing that out.
You know what? Don't feel bad. When I was in college, I carried around a skateboard for an entire year, even though I didn't know how to skateboard. So I would drive to a party, get out, walk up with my skateboard, and then the last block until the party, I would kind of stumble my way up and then try and kick it up, usually unsuccessfully, and walk in. Because for me, in the absence of having an identity, I needed to simply create a fictional one.
Hmm.
It's like, I don't know how to have no identity, but I'm really good at taking on phony ones, because at least then I feel like I have a chance at connecting and bonding with some particular demographic of the community around me, even if it's just for a moment.
So what's your identity now?
Oh my gosh, like, I don't know. I mean, I'm so, you know, in some of these personality tests I've taken, you know, whether they're, you know, divine or of the devil, I don't really know.
Yeah.
But in taking those, it seems there's a pattern that forms that says that so much of my quest in life is to form an identity. The problem with that quest is that if you figure out your identity, well, then you have no quest for the remainder of your life. So you're constantly finding one, deconstructing it, and then finding another one. And so you kind of become this unintentional chameleon. I mean, nobody wants to have their life completely fulfilled when they're, I'm 36, when they're 36, cause it's like, well, what am I gonna do for my remaining years? And so I feel like currently I'm in kind of one of those in-between phases where, am I an artist or am I just someone who wants to believe he's an artist? You know, am I a good husband? I've been married for 10 and a half years.
Wow.
Or am I someone who just wants to believe that he's a good husband? Do I hate my dad? Maybe. Or did I really, really love my dad? I don't know. And so I feel like I'm always kind of like between ports of my own identity, because whenever I find one, there's this contentment that settles in that doesn't propel me forward relationally or artistically. And I don't know what to do with that. But you...
It's just so interesting that you're saying this, because to me, an identity, you're equating that with being fulfilled.
Yeah.
But I don't know if anybody ever truly finds himself. I think it's a constant evolution. I think that, think about who you dated. Someone I dated in high school is not someone who I would date now, because I wasn't who I was then, and I don't want to be then.
Yeah.
I think the more experiences you add on to your human experience, that kind of is who you are right now, but that's not who you might be tomorrow. And I think that's what's like, that's why life is so beautiful, right? You're shifting.
Yeah.
I don't think,
Well, hopefully we are, right? I mean, I think that's the hope. And I think that probably speaks to so much of what was maybe hard about for all of us, at least for me, and as you kind of voiced before, about some of those adolescent years, is it feels like unless you have an identity, you have nowhere to belong. And while those identities may be false, I mean, all kind of Breakfast Club, you know, different parts that you have to just adapt and adopt in order to be somebody or to fit. I think it's natural, you're right, that we would change. And certainly, I think the creative process is part of what changes us. So you had this innate, from the pacifier, love or attachment to music.
Yeah.
When did you really start to kind of believe that it could be something that you could or would want to invest a lot of your time and efforts into?
So I've always been somebody with a tremendous amount of passion and passions. I love food, I love working out, and I love philanthropy. Like, I have so many sectors of my life, and there's so many paths that I think I could go down and be really happy. And that's kind of where I'm struggling at currently, because I have so many things that I want to do, and I have trouble almost attaching myself to that one, because like, almost similar to your identity conversation before, it's who am I? What do I want to be? Who do I want to be known as, instead of just being happy with the process? And I think we all kind of have trouble with that. But I forgot your question.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
I get caught in the thought.
The questions are irrelevant. The answer, the answer, your answers are so wonderful. Oh. Yeah, but when did music go from being something that you really resonated with and connected with to something that you wanted to create and really create beyond just, you know, for 1 hour of your life?
Yeah. I think so many big decisions of mine come out of heartbreak. And it was the end of college. I was dating somebody for 4 years, and it ended. and it just wasn't working. It was a beautiful relationship, but we kind of grew out of each other. And it was first semester senior year. I'm like, okay, I have a year left of college. How am I going to maximize my time? And prior to that, I kind of dabbled in, I was in an a cappella group very haphazardly. I wasn't really very involved, but I threw myself into six singing groups. I was in an a cappella group, a different one, a gospel choir, a 90s cover band. I started my own band. Like, I really went for
Wonderful.
It.
Wonderful.
And then I left college after having all these like big aha moments of, oh my God, okay, let's see what happens. I had a psychology degree and an Italian minor. I had no idea what the hell I was going to do with both of those things. How do you combine? How do you extract from those?
Yeah.
Am I going to be a therapist? Because I love talking to people. I was thinking of getting my my master's in social work. I literally had no freaking idea what I was going to do. And then I just went for it. And I connected with people in music afterward, and I kind of haven't looked back. I don't even know what it took a very interesting road. I was working with a DJ who was addicted to horse pills, and I would go to his house in Westchester. I hope he's not listening to this. And it would just be a very odd scene. He had a wife, but they would have like foursomes like there.
Yeah, right.
Music could be very dark.
Yeah.
And I honestly, from there, it just kind of like rebounded off of each other. Like all my different experiences kind of sequentially happened.
Were you afraid of taking this on? I mean, was there fears of I don't know, either failure or rejection along the way?
I read my journal recently from those years, from like 3 or 4 years ago, and it was me comparing myself. It was so interesting, but it was the Facebook era. So I'm like, oh my God, I went on Facebook and this girl just got a huge record deal. What am I doing? Yeah. This isn't happening fast enough. I think in this day and age, we're like voyeurs, right? Mm-hmm. We can look into someone's life. You know where someone went on vacation. You haven't spoken to someone in 4 years. It's such a weird world we're living in right now. So I think you're smart actually not to be on social media, because that definitely is attributing to a lot of my anxiety and my like self-deprecation. But I think, I don't know. I think I just did it. I didn't even think. And I think about what I was doing, and it's kind of sad. I once dressed up and got all my hair and makeup done, and I sang to an audience of two, my mom and my boyfriend at the time, and the bartender. And I just, but I gave it my all, because that's what you have to do. You can't just half-ass it. You have to just be. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the experience.
Yeah. Well, I would think that fear, from my end, when I create things, fear is kind of critical to the process. Mm-hmm. I was reading an interview with the director of the film The Revenant.
Mm.
I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name and butcher it or whatever. But
Spaniard.
Yeah. But he was talking about how fear almost becomes this, you know, my translation of what he said would be, it becomes this lighthouse that you almost pursue as an artist, because you know that these places you're afraid of are largely untapped areas of your own psychology, your own emotions, your own creativity. And so if you're always comfortable in this creative waters in which you sail, you're probably just retreading the same waters. And so in my life, I don't like that, because I don't want to be afraid, because I feel like I'm afraid enough as it is. But I can't deny the fact that oftentimes my fear hasn't been something that I need to turn and run from, but it's really something that I need to kind of step closer to and engage, because a lot of times those are the pockets of me that I haven't explored, and that becomes the ripest place from which I can create.
Fear is growth, I think. I think as long as it's not disabling you in some way, because that's definitely happened to me in the past, where it got to a point where I was so fearful that I didn't even want to go for something or put myself out there.
Now tell me about that, because that's important that in what you've been creating, both as an artist and as just a human, has gotten you to that place. So talk about that.
Yeah, I think I moved to LA with the purpose of doing something a bit out of my comfort zone. I could have stayed in New York, but I got, and it's so funny, so many of my musical experiences are defined by my relationship, so that's a whole other conversation. It's interesting. But I think as a writer, I need things to write about. I need heartbreak. I need passion. I need love. I need something to kind of fuel my words. And maybe you feel similarly, like all of your experiences are etched in your words too.
Yeah, whether you like them or not.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I moved to LA, and then I got into a relationship, and then another relationship, and fear of what these men were going to think about me and how they were going to define, like, what, like, oh my God, maybe they won't like this picture I'm going to post on Instagram. Maybe they won't like if I do this show. And it's definitely inhibited me a lot. And my mom got married at 21 years old and had a beautiful career blooming. And my dad didn't support it. And she curtailed it and then didn't work for 30 years and was miserable. So I'm just really careful about not letting me personally, and I'm sure a lot of women feel this way because it's a hard balance. You want to be this strong, empowered feminist woman, but you also want to be in a relationship and be able to balance those things. So you have to be with a strong man or woman, whoever you're with.
Sure.
And they have to support you.
One of the most terrifying moments I've ever had creatively was I was on vacation with my in-laws a few years ago, and this is before I had a book coming out. And I gave – my wife had already read an advanced copy, and I gave it to my father-in-law. Mm. And to my horror, he read it while we were on vacation. So we're in Palm Springs, and I'm sitting on the pool deck, you know, with my margarita or whatever it was. And he's standing on the edge of the pool reading this thing 10 feet from me. Now, he was doing it as a gesture of love. Like, he was doing it really to show me that he couldn't wait to get home. Mm-hmm. He didn't care who was around. I mean, it was his way of supporting me.
Yeah.
But I remember inside just wanting to vanish because I was so terrified. I'm far more scared of being rejected by the people I know than the people that I don't, which is probably similar to a lot of people. But the reason is because I have to keep seeing those people. If someone I don't know in a city or some reader in another country hates what I do, it hurts. But I don't have to see them again and feel the shame kind of rise up. But I knew with him, if he didn't like what I did, if he thought not only that it was poor artistically, but if it shed some kind of gloomy light on who his daughter had married, I was going to have to see that all the time. And so at the end of our vacation, he finished the book that morning. And as my wife and I were flying out and going back to, I think, Austin, which is where we were living at the time, He took me out to coffee, and he set this, you know, just big bound manuscript down on the table. And my father-in-law is not, he's a very emotional man, but he's not one to demonstrate that emotion physically. And I saw these tears welling up in his eyes, and he said, he's like, Josh, he's like, he was so complimentary and so encouraging about the craft of writing. And then he paused. I remember he put his hand down on top of the manuscript and he looked at me and he goes, but there's just so much pain here. And I didn't know what to do with that because I knew he was right. And he looked at me and he said, my fear for you, and again, I'm married to his daughter. So when he says my fear for you, he means my fear for you and my fear for my daughter.
Of course.
He said, my fear for you is that you don't know how to live without pain, and so you're always going to seek it. Wow. And on the one hand, it was like, you know, devastating, of course. But on the other hand, it was such a pivotal moment in my creative process to ask myself that question. Do I know how to create apart from pain? Do I know how to create apart from heartache? And it's just, it's really bloomed a wonderful philosophical question. Like, can I create out of heartbreak, but also out of joy? Can I create out of devastation, but also out of euphoria? Or am I, as an artist, only established on one end of my emotional spectrum? But that was a huge, that moment was terrifying for me.
Yeah.
And it probably remains my scariest moment in creating, but it's become so pivotal in moving me forward, not only as an artist, but as a man.
Does it matter, do you think, if you have to be on one end of the spectrum? Because for me, I have a lot of songwriter friends, and I have a brilliant writer that I know in my life, and she only can write when she's devastated by loss of any kind. And that's the only time she's truly inspired. So she is constantly seeking destructive relationships, surrounding herself with toxic people. And it's fascinating to me because she's choosing to sacrifice happiness to give back to the world in a meaningful way in her mind. Like, that's how she contributes.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, the writer Cormac McCarthy, he would say if an artistic endeavor doesn't take years of your life and drive you to suicide, it's not worth it.
Mm.
You know, I mean, obviously Shakespeare crafted almost, I mean, the majority of his work was tragedy. I mean, Charles Bukowski, the great poet in the 60s, said, find what you love and let it kill you.
Hmm.
So, I mean, he also said love is a dog from hell. So I don't think, I mean, ultimately, as artists, we go where we have to go in order to make things.
Yeah.
That's what we do. But maybe for me, it was just terrifying to think that I was wired toward that end of the spectrum, because I don't know if I had ever really perceived myself that way, which again comes back to my gnarled, tangled mess of identity and understanding who I am. But I also, I do want to be able to create out of joy, because I don't want to force myself there when I'm not there. I don't want to have to manufacture and warp my soul unnecessarily. I never want to be afraid to be there.
Yeah.
But I don't want to treat my wife or friends poorly just so I become more isolated. I don't see, for me personally, any glory in self-destructing simply so that I can make something. To me, the end doesn't justify the means for me. Now, for others, it might. For me personally, it doesn't.
Do you have a specific creative process?
Oh my
writing?
Gosh.
Is it extremely...
You answer that first.
Me?
You answer that first, and then I'll try and make mine sound better.
Well, the thing for me is it really manifests itself so differently. Like, whether it's me scribbling on my pad on my phone, like the little, like the yellow pad.
Oh, yeah, the little, like the sticky notes?
Yeah.
Oh,
so yeah. I have about 4,000 of them in my phone. I'm just like kind of inanely scribing.
I love that.
Or voice memos, or it's me writing. It's so funny. I have like so many different elements of my person that needs to come out, and I don't know. It really, it's like, do I want to write on like a notepad today, or do I want to write on my phone, or do I want to just not write at all and just remember it?
Yep.
I think it's just so dependent on what the context is.
Has your creative process changed or evolved since you first began?
Absolutely. I think like when I'm writing a song, I always go with the melody first, and like for the most part, I'll like come up with a chord progression, and then from there, I'll see what it brings up for me. Is it sad? Is it happy? Is it nostalgic? And then from there, I kind of think of words or memories or just whatever it evokes for me, and then I kind of go from there.
Wow. See, my creative process is probably much more clumsy than that. Like yours sounds very professional. Mine sounds a little bit, barbaric. But for me, I never know what I'm doing. I just start. I've never been an outliner. So when I'm writing a book or a poem or whatever, crafting a story that I'm going to tell in a live environment, I just start. And because for me, I'm probably the analogy would be that I'm probably much more like a sculptor in the way that I need a lump to mold. Mm. And so I just need to get something down and then shape it, as opposed to like having this really forecasted endpoint and here's what it's going to be. So I've never outlined bullet points. You know, I want to be in a straitjacket whenever I see bullet points or if there's a list of anything. I don't really thrive in that. Mine tends to just be more like wander out into the dark and see what you find, which I actually kind of enjoy.
Yeah.
But that's again where I get caught in that comparison trap of going, oh, but if I was as much of a genius as this person, I would be able to really map it out from the beginning. And most days I'm okay with my process. But there's certainly the times when I kind of have this lust for having the other gift set that through 36 years I have never quite attained.
Is it a gift, though?
I don't know.
I think the process is so personal. It's like saying I like bananas and you like oranges. I don't know if there's like a right or wrong. Like, I think it's beautiful. There's something about something being so organic that you just write. Like, that to me is very inspiring.
Do you rely on desperation as you work?
Yeah.
Tell me about desperation.
Desperation.
Missy. Yeah. Tell
Elaborate.
Me about desperation.
Just...
Well, let's see. There's the adage that says artists are desperate people, and when they lose their desperation, they cease to be artists.
I view desperation as passion. Is that?
Sure.
Do you
You can talk about it that way. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a relational person?
Very much so. I form very intense attachments to people. Not in a
stalker way. That doesn't surprise me after spending however many minutes it's been with you, yeah.
I don't know. Do you ever wonder what your purpose is? Like, I think everyone is brought into the world with a gift or something they're supposed to just bring out into the world on whatever level it is. It could be as small as, I don't even know, having a child and bringing that child to life, or it's as big as whatever it is. But I just feel like I really am meant to connect with people. Like, I really love people so much. And ever since I was young, my mom told me I used to go up to strangers and tell them I love them. Literally, she
That's
used
very
to
sweet.
After school every single day, she would make me watch a video. Don't talk to strangers.
No, and you ignored that.
Ignored it.
You
I
said,
still
oh,
do.
By don't talk to strangers, you mean tell them I love them?
No, I'm the girl who like gets an Uber driver a job. Like I'm very strange. Like I learn someone's life story in 5 minutes, and that's my. I love it. I need to. It's like a weird need. It's not even like.
No,
a,
that's not. That's well.
It's just. It's.
You can call it weird in the sense that it's not the common way that no. human beings interact, but. I mean, to me, that's like, I don't know, that's a rare and intoxicating thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially in light of everything we're saying, you know, people who afraid, people anxious, people comparing themselves to other people. Someone who actually wants to, like, get to know a person and not their profile, like, yeah. that's a wonderful trait.
And it's interesting in LA because I think a lot of relationships tend to be a bit surface, and I'm not even trying to stereotype, but I've lived it for almost 4 years. Hmm. And it's interesting. I find myself like in a room and people are very topical and they're not interested in knowing inner layers ever.
Yeah.
Like I'll know somebody for 3 years and they don't really know anything about me.
Huh.
They know what I do and what I've done and who yeah. I know, but they don't really.
Do you consider yourself a lonely person?
An interesting question, because sometimes I could feel lonely with people.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like that?
Sure. Yeah. There's a difference between isolated and alone,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. I mean, I isolate intentionally to work, but at times that ceases to be about work productivity, and it starts to just become fear of interaction and fear of being known, while I simultaneously want it, but. I think loneliness is not necessarily a bad thing, in that loneliness is kind of, you know, in my understanding, the soul's way of telling you you need connection.
Mm.
And so my problem is my loneliness mechanism is a little bit broken. And so I don't really become lonely until I've been isolated for a really, really long time. And then it takes a lot for me to connect with people again.
What does that look like?
Well, I mean, I suppose I would liken myself similar to you, and then I don't really enjoy being social, but I enjoy being relational. And so sitting with you here, like I get less. The work you do is great, and it's you know, it's inspiring, it's good, it's ambitious. But for me, I don't get excited to sit with someone and know what sports teams they like and what their job is and leave going, but I don't really know anything about them.
Mm.
I know what they've done. I know the back of their, you know, proverbial baseball card, but I don't really know them. And so for me, if I leave an interaction with somebody feeling either that I don't know them or that I'm not known, there tends to be something, this just kind of hollow echo that resonates with me for a while. And that's part of why a lot of times I'd prefer to sit amongst books and films and with my dog, who's not a French bulldog. I know you're a fan of French bulldogs, but you know, I'd prefer to be alone sometimes, because at least then I can say I feel lonely because I'm not around people, as opposed to being in a social setting and going, I feel so alone, and there's a million people around.
Yeah. It's almost worse sometimes. It's almost easier to be alone by yourself, to be feeling lonely by yourself.
Do you feel like you need long stretches of solitude in order to create?
I definitely need – it's funny. I'm an interesting balance between getting energy from being around people. I find there's a weird thing that's activated, and I notice, and I don't even know what it's called. But when I'm around – when I'm in a specific environment, it kind of become this very energetic. It almost feels like I get a shot of adrenaline when I'm just around people and I'm talking to people and I'm just being completely myself. There's something so beautiful and authentic and raw.
Yeah.
But then that exhausts me, and then I kind of need to regroup and recharge, and then I need my alone time, whether it's like doing a yoga class or just walking or just being by myself.
I understand.
I don't know if that makes any
sense. It makes complete sense. I typically, when I leave an interaction with, if I'm on like a double date or something, I'll leave.
Yeah.
My wife and I leave, double date or whatever social setting, and the moment everyone is gone, close the door, we walk out onto, you know, Hudson or 6th Avenue or whatever, and I go, was I okay? Was I okay? Because I have this, like, you know, sometimes after, like, really prolonged isolation, which I have sometimes, I engage people and I go, I don't. I forget. Like sometimes I can be a little invasive with the questions I ask.
But you're a writer. I feel like that's your job. You are.
Yeah, but not everyone wants me to have my job imposed on them when we're drinking wine.
Yeah. Well, people are like, oh yeah, the weather's great. Like they don't want to get into anything very hearty.
One time when I really weirded someone out, it was so fun. we were at this like. My wife has been in fashion for years, and we're sitting at this like dinner with all these like awesome people and whatever, and I'm sitting across from this couple, and I don't know what they were talking about, and I kind of leaned forward and slid my plate aside, and I said, I don't know either of you at all, but I would bet you $1 million I can guess the character that both of you use in Mario Kart.
Wow.
and they looked at me. They look at me and they're like, you know, okay. And I looked at both of them. And this is all like, this is just like a parlor trick. But I look at all of them and I go, okay, you're wearing a bow tie. So you like being refined. You don't like being imposing. So you're not going to be Kong and you're not going to be Bowser. So I'm going to rule those out right away. Then I looked at her and I go, and you're very strong. And so you don't want people to think that you're weak, so you're not going to be the princess wearing the pink dress. And so I kind of methodically eliminate those things, and I look at both of them, and I go, you're always Toad, and you're always Yoshi. And they look at me, and they go, yes.
Are you kidding?
It was so fun, yeah. But I just like steering interactions to a point where I get to know who somebody is. Because at, like, a table of fashionistas, typically, someone isn't going to cough up that we play Mario Kart for 5 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You know, once we strip down and, you know, we have potato chips on our chests or whatever.
Yeah.
But to me, that's like a glimpse. Like for example, and I'll ask you this question. I heard someone say before, it was my therapist, actually. She said, if you really want to get to know somebody, don't ask them what they do. Don't ask them where they're from. She said, ask them what they daydream about.
Wow.
So, Missy, what do you daydream about?
Yesterday, I was daydreaming about going to Italy.
Now, you speak Italian, is that right?
I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. For me, that also is like a very safe space. I always, when I daydream, I think of where I'm the happiest. Hmm. What makes me feel safe? Where do I feel comfortable? And you know, it's interesting that I'm choosing a place on the other side of the world or a different country that I feel safe.
Have you been there?
Yeah, I lived there for a year.
What is it about the thought of Italy that makes you feel safe?
I think it's freedom. I was like very untethered there. I was just exploring. And I think the journey of just, it's hard to be happy. I don't think it's easy. I think it's a job. So for me, I think when I was there, it was a place where I truly was, it was my job to be happy. And now in this interesting period of flux, and it's so funny because, and you're being so kind with your words about accomplishments. And I feel the same way about you. And we're both sitting here and talking very openly about how we're still struggling with identity. Yeah. So it's just so interesting, like your external people's vision of who you are is very often different than what you feel about yourself.
Yeah. I find that to be true a lot, and I still don't understand it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, another thing my 12-step sponsor said to me one time is he said, Josh, your greatest fear is that the world sees you like you do. Mm. And I was, you know, and then once I, you know, scooped my soul up off the floor and, you know, put it back in my chest, I was just like, man, that's so, so true. And I think I crave so much to just not have to hide, to just not have to pretend. And when I hear you talking about Italy and safe and being happy and that there wasn't necessarily an agenda, I hear, like, I don't know, maybe I'm inferring too much, but it sounds like that's part of what it was. You just felt this sort of liberty to be you and not have to be whatever people maybe back in a more familiar environment expected you to be, or to bear the burden of the expectations they kind of thrust upon you. I mean, that sounds pretty fantastic. That's why I always love being with my dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love that bumper sticker. What is it? God, help me become the man my dog thinks I am.
Aww,
you know, it's sweet. Like that whole thing. It's like, in the eyes of my little Shiba Inu, he's never going, ah, Dad, you know what? I mean, geez, like that poem, really, that wasn't your best.
Yeah.
Or you know what? Like that wasn't consistent enough. Or, you know, it wasn't any of these things. I feel complete autonomy from my own fears, from my own anxieties, from my own self-hatred. And that's And as a creative, those are such amazing moments to just come up out of that, like, intense stew and just have, like, a moment of levity. It's like those moments, whether for you it's Italy, for me it's watching the Chicago Bears, or, you know, sitting down and having a beer with a friend. Those are like this oasis amidst this, like, intense creative journey that, you know, you and I are both kind of on every single day.
It's so interesting because for me, comfort, feeling a little too complacent, stifles my creativity. Mm-hmm. But there needs to be a bit of familiarity. Like, yeah. I can't be completely thrown off.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
You need to have like a bit of a ritual, but also for me, at least, be inspired by something a bit unfamiliar.
Now, what are those things here for you? I mean, we're not in Italy.
Mm-hmm. So I know. It sounds so delusional. It's Italy is my safe space.
Oh my gosh, I wish we could all get on a plane right now. It's absolutely amazing. But here, I mean, you know, between New York and LA, what are those kind of familiar things that you gravitate towards in order to just give you a respite from the intensity?
I think I'm very close with my mom and my sister, and I think having them, they're very tethering for me. Like, I do the check-in. We'd speak multiple times throughout the day. It's probably a little bit unhealthy. We're like Gilmore Girls plus one. But I don't know. I think family for me is definitely brings familiarity and comfort, but they're also, when I'm in LA, they're not there. So it's an interesting thing. Like, I know they're here. And I think something within myself, just doing kind of things that I would do anywhere.
Yeah.
Whether it's just a walk or, I don't even know, eating specific foods. It's, like, pretty simple. I don't know. It's nothing too crazy. Yeah.
But that's good. I mean, because then that means you can kind of, they're transportable, right? I mean, you can kind of carry them into whatever season of life. I get scared when I need something exotic in order to rescue me on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Because it's like, okay, yeah, if what I, like, my wife and I talk about this all the time, if we need a vacation, we need something more than a vacation.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to have I guess it's the notion that I don't want to have to escape my life. I want to have a life that I don't have to escape, you know, and what does that look like? And for me, some of those kind of little, like, handrails, those daily handrails for me are so, so critical, not only to just my stability as a person, but to my, the reservoir of creativity that I need in order to make things.
Do you do well with structure? Do you prefer kind of a schedule?
I mean, yes and no. I'm fine with it as long as I'm the master of that structural card. Mm-hmm. I don't do well when it's other people are holding that. But for me, I'm pretty regimented. I mean, I get up about the same time every day, the exact same breakfast. I write throughout the day and read, you know, 8 to 10 hours every day. I eat the exact same lunch. I work out at the same time. I eat the exact same thing when I'm done working out. And then I transition into my night. And part of that is because it just seems to be when my creativity is most fertile. Mm-hmm. But the other reason is I don't like wasting my energy on other things. Like, I don't want to think about what I'm going to have for lunch because I want to be able to leverage all that energy into my work. I don't want to think about what time I'm going to get up because I want to be able to leverage even that little seed of energy into my work. What do you like? Tell me about the music you like.
What music do I like?
Yeah, and not like you like it, and it's like, oh, this is great. Like, here's a Wham song that I have nostalgia about. But I mean, like, music that for you really kind of resonates with you.
I deviate between growing up with 90s techno music and Frank Sinatra for my dad.
Okay.
His eclectic taste. And then my mom loved the big ballads of Celine Dion and Barbara Streisand Broadway.
Okay.
So it's a very interesting amalgamation of different sounds.
Do you see traces of all those in your own work?
I love telling stories, and I think that maybe comes from the Broadway element. And I love musicals. Hmm. Like, I still Hamilton. Call me a fangirl, but I definitely am of Lim.
Yeah.
Lin.
You have a huge.
I love Lib.
Well, for everyone who can't see Missy's face right now, she is. Her smile has not been blushing. Bigger since she's been in this room talking about Hamilton.
No, I love Hamilton.
Yeah.
I love musicals. There's something to me that's so human about it. And I know it's like the opposite of human because no one goes dancing and singing in the streets. And
right.
It's not necessarily the most realistic thing.
Right.
But it's very I don't know. You're just like, you don't give a shit.
Yeah.
You're
just... Well, and there's this very kind of base human raw quality that you go, whether or not they are actually Jean Valjean, they are crying right now. Like they are weeping, you know, regardless of what they're wearing or whether this is happening in song, there is this kind of feral human emotional experience that happens in a crowd of, you know, anywhere from 20 to 2,000 people. It's really amazing.
But in terms of what inspires me, I feel like I'm more inspired by the words of songs or melodies than specific genres. It's weird. I'll get obsessed with a song and I love it. And I'll listen to that song on repeat for like a month.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I get a little OCD about it. And then I'll deconstruct it. What is it about this song that I'm resonating with?
Yeah.
Is it the melody? Is it the words? Is it the message? Is it the artist? And then I literally, it's like a song a week or a song a month that I like really hone in on.
Tell me about Rhythm of the Night, Missy. I've listened to it like 5 times.
Did you like it?
I did.
Aww,
I did.
Thank you. Yeah. So that was my...
I don't want to try and describe it because you can tell me about that.
That was just an interesting... So I haven't put anything out as an artist in 4 years, maybe more, because I've been kind of focused on writing for other artists and building up my music licensing company, and because I just wanted a bit more control over what I was doing, because I was going into these rooms and writing with people, and we'd be pitching these songs thinking that this is what Rihanna wanted, when in turn they wanted reggae, but then, no, they actually want a dance song that's a bit darker. So it's very hard to forecast what the artist wants unless you're in the room with them. But even then, it's very competitive. And everything's hard when it's worthwhile. I don't think it should be easy.
Yeah.
But something about it just became a bit frustrating for me, so I wanted a bit more control over what I was doing. But I wanted to do Rhythm of the Night because I felt I really missed performing, and I really missed my voice being out there, whether or not it made any kind of impact. I just felt like it was something I needed to do. And that song is extremely nostalgic to me. It was one of my favorite songs growing up. I love that. It's actually probably one of my favorite songs. And I wanted to just do a little bit of a twist on it. And yeah, I just put it out with a good friend of mine, and I'm working on some other things. But again, the fear thing, it's like, okay, it's been already almost 2 months. I should have put it out a month ago. The next follow-up song, which is an original. So I don't know.
Are you hard on yourself?
Extremely hard on myself.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think artists are very hard on themselves. We've chosen a career that's very – we're not – choosing a structured 9-to-5 job where you go in and you leave.
Right.
We're choosing to really give ourselves to something bigger than us.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be a bit hard on yourself.
Wow. Yeah.
Are you hard on yourself?
I mean, I say yes. I agree. It's like for me to kind of, you know, beat myself senseless a bit, it serves me well in some ways. But then I also have to have days where I just say, you know what, it's okay. Like, it's okay. Today wasn't your best day. It's a mulligan. Shake it off. And so it doesn't always serve me best. So I have to kind of like a coach would with a player, find out how to psychologically reach me on that particular day. But that's part of what creating in general has taught me about me. Is I've learned that there's a lot more in me, but sometimes I have to be hard on myself to get it out. But then other times I need to be more maternal with my own, you know, gifts and talents, and just go, hey, you know what, it's okay to just sit down and be sad and feel like you want to quit today, and tomorrow, you know, we're just going to get up and try again. And that, I suppose, that for me is my goal on a daily basis is just to show up. I'm just going to show up, and I'm going to give everything I have to this today, because sadly, there are artists all over the world who today are not showing up because of whatever happened yesterday or a month ago or 6 years ago, or because of something that their teacher said to them 15 years ago. And so today, despite the court of voices in my head telling me otherwise, I'm just going to show up and give it a shot and see who I become in the process.
So you say you're critical of yourself.
Yeah.
So is there anything that you can think about that would actually fill that void in your whatever you think is missing that is not making you 100% pleased?
Yeah, I mean, no.
What's next? Like, if you think,
sadly.
Like, big dream,
No, I mean, I'm chasing a unicorn, and I know that, like, I'm chasing something that doesn't exist. And I only know that because if you were to rewind 10 years and say, if you had pitched to me 10 years ago the life I have today, I would have signed in 2 seconds and gone, oh my gosh, you know, incredible wife who I love, you know, to be a best-selling author and to get the whatever, to be healthy, to have friends that care about me. I would sign up for that in a second. But then once I'm actually wearing those garments, I go, yeah, but. And so, and that, I suppose that brings us back to something you were saying that was so good. There has to be a sense of hunger, right? But then the question becomes, can you be content and hungry at the same time? And I don't know if that's possible. Maybe it is, but my suspicion is that it's not possible. That the only way I'm going to maintain a sense of comfort is to always have an element of discontent, to think there's more. There's more out there. There's better writing. There's something else. And so that's kind of that strange juxtaposition, I guess, in which I am batted back and forth every single day, Missy. You are so great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for hanging out with us.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks so much for listening to The Marrow. To find me on social media for a calendar of my upcoming live appearances or to purchase one of my books, you can visit joshreebach.com. Please join me again next week.
My name's Nico Tortorella. Listen to my podcast called The Love Bomb, where we celebrate love right here every Tuesday on At Will Radio.